One of the challenges in an attempt at giving a narrative history of something as large and complex as the Christian church and faith, that's a neat and clean timeline. The story of the church didn't take place in just one place, through one or two individuals. Within just a generation of Christ and the apostles, the church had already planted in many places. That means in our attempt here at charting the course of church history in a more popular and less scholarly manner, we have to bounce around in both time and place. Those who track each episode will note that there are times that I repeat material that we've already covered. I have to because it picks up a thread of the tale that we've already covered, but takes it in a new direction. So please bear with me as we occasionally cover ground that we've already traversed. Spread over three pages in Volume 3 of his monumental work, History of the Christian Church, the author Philip Schaff makes a compelling argument for why it was inevitable that Christianity would eventually emerge from the Roman catacombs to join the state in governing the hearts and the lives of the people of the empire. While inevitable, Schaff describes how the merger resulted in the corruption of the church. He wrote, quote, "The Christianizing of the state amounted in great measure to the paganizing and secularizing of the church," unquote. We've already seen how the church at Rome emerged to become a headquarters of Western Christianity. We need to spend a little more time there, as this period of church history is crucial for understanding the eventual rift that occurred between East and West, and what emerged in Europe after that. Not only for the church, but for the nations that arose there. The idea of the rule of the entire church by the Roman Pope was a slow and halting process. In fact, the title Pope, or Papa, wasn't important to the emergence of the Bishop of Rome as the leader of the church. It was a term of affection used by many Christians for their pastor, and was used in a more formal sense at Alexandria in Egypt decades before it was used of the Roman bishop. It wasn't until the 6th century that the word Pope was reserved exclusively for Rome's bishop, long after he'd already claimed primacy as Peter's successor. It's important as well that we make a distinction between the honor the Roman Church held and the overarching authority its bishop later claimed. There's ample evidence of the respect that was accorded Rome's Christian community. Rome was, after all, the capital of the empire. The church there was the largest and the richest, and by the mid-3rd century, it claimed some 30,000 members that were served by 150 priests, supporting 1,500 widows and the poor. It had a long record of remaining orthodox and generous. And for these reasons, it was regarded as the lead church of the Western Empire. Though there's no solid historical evidence to support it, Christians of the 2nd through the 4th centuries believed that Peter and Paul had founded the church at Rome. It was thought that each bishop of Rome handed his authority and his office to his successor so that the current pope, whoever that was sitting in the apostolic seat of Peter. And we can see why this would be important to the church when the Gnostics were a threat to the faith. Remember, they claimed to possess a special and secret knowledge and traditions that had been passed on from Jesus to the apostles and then to them. In contrast to this fiction, Rome could actually name their bishops all the way back to the original apostles. That list was memorized by young believers, like, you know, state capitals are memorized by students today. While the church at Rome was regarded with great respect by most believers, that honor, quite frankly, didn't always extend to its bishop. There's much evidence of church fathers like Irenaeus and Cyprian who disagreed vehemently with positions taken by the Bishop of Rome. Until Constantine, there's no evidence that the church at large took direction from Rome's lead pastor. Now, it's important at this point to speak about the changes that took place in the structure of the churches during the 3rd and 4th centuries. That change really pretty much came about for two reasons: councils and archbishops. The first development that led to an alteration in the way that churches developed was church councils. As the church grew and individual congregations developed in more places, leaders of the church recognized the need to coordinate their efforts and their teaching. The emergence of heretics prompted elders and pastors to gather together to discuss well, how to address the challenge of false teaching and false teachers. These gatherings were at first informal and irregular, called at random by provincial leaders whenever some problem arose. In the 3rd century, they began meeting annually in more formal councils to share news and establish policy that would be observed in every church. These provincial councils proved so helpful that in the 4th century, several provinces started sending their bishops to larger regional councils. When Constantine became emperor and the churches faced major obstacles, the call was sent out for all bishops to meet. The first such general or ecumenical council was held in 314 at Arles. Although only the Western church leaders were called, that one, the first true all-church council, of course, was held at Nicaea, not far from Constantinople in 325, and you'll remember it dealt with the problem of Arianism. The findings of these general councils became the rule for the churches. But the second development that helped shape the church was the emergence of archbishops. During the provincial and the regional councils, all bishops were supposed to be equals. But in practice, some of the older bishops and those who led larger, older, and more respected churches, well, they were held in higher regard. Also, as the church grew, it tended to locate first in urban centers and then reached out to their surrounding rural countrysides, where smaller churches sprang up, usually led by pastors that had been sent out by the pastor of the nearest urban center. Of course, it was natural that these rural pastors would look to their sending church as their spiritual home and their sending pastor as their spiritual leader. In other words, rural bishops looked to urban bishops as archbishops. He might in turn look to some other bishop of an even larger city closer to Rome, Alexandria, Antioch, or Constantinople as his spiritual overseer. So while all bishops were theoretically equal, practically they related to one another in a more hierarchical way, a hierarchy based on the size and the prominence of the church and the city where the bishop served. You can see where this is going, can't you? You know, put church councils attended by archbishops together with a church suddenly given access to imperial favor, and it's a proverbial Pandora's box of political scheming. The move of the empire's political capital from Rome to Constantinople in 330 shifted the center of political gravity 900 miles east. Because location and proximity to political power had become increasingly important, suddenly Constantinople was added to the list of Christian centers, and the Bishop of Constantinople became another major player. When Theodosius became emperor in 379 and made Christianity the official state religion, church politics moved to a whole new level. Hundreds of people feigned conversion and entered the church merely to gain a political advantage. As we tracked in an earlier episode, in May of 381, Emperor Theodosius convened a general council in Constantinople, but only called the eastern bishops to attend. Bishop Damasus of Rome wasn't even invited. Theodosius wanted to close the book on Arianism, and so he convened the council to endorse and ratify the Nicene Creed. The eastern bishops decided to use the council to raise their political coin by also ruling that the Bishop of Constantinople was second only to the Bishop of Rome in terms of authority. And they based this on the premise that Constantinople was the new Rome. Well, in Rome, Pope Damasus recognized this for what it was, a political power play. He and other Western bishops responded in their own council a year later that Rome's prominence wasn't due to its proximity to the capital, but due to its historic connection to Peter and Paul. It was from this council at Rome in 382 that the church first claimed the, quote, primacy of the Roman church, unquote, based on Jesus' remark that he would build his church on a rock, Rome, of course, assuming that rock was Peter. Now, it was obvious by the end of the 4th century that East and West were headed in different directions. The Eastern Church, with its center at Constantinople, it became increasingly tied to imperial power. In the West, things were dramatically different. Imperial power and presence were dissolving. The church wasn't only untying from political structures as those structures themselves dissolved. The church was increasingly looked to by the common people to provide governance because the government wasn't doing it anymore. After Damasus, the Roman bishop most responsible for the emergence of the papal office was Leo the Great. Now, Leo was a nobleman and politician who was made bishop of Rome when Pope Sextus III died in AD 440. Leo's 21-year term as Pope saw some of Rome's most tumultuous years. He drew on themes already in place to support his primacy over the entire church. Okay, here we go. It's at this point that I need to say that we're going to deviate from our usual course and toss out some things that, well, they may upset our Roman Catholic friends. But this is a period of church history that speaks specifically to the issue of the primacy of the papacy. Now, trust me, when we get to later church history, we'll have lots of tough stuff to look at in regard to the Protestants. Leo's claim to primacy, and that the Roman Pope was the spiritual successor to Peter as leader of the church, based as it was largely on Matthew 16, where Jesus told Peter that he would build his church on the rock, now that seems to fly in the face of Jesus' clear teaching that in the church, the great are not to ape the world's patterns of power and rule. The great are to serve. As Bruce Shelley notes in his marvelous church history, in plain language, the primacy of Peter as leader of the church is difficult to glean from Matthew 16, when just a few verses later, Jesus rebuked Peter and called him Satan. Peter denied the Lord at his trial, and even after the filling of the Holy Spirit, recorded in Acts 2, the Apostle Paul had to rebuke him for being a hypocrite. Another reason to question the primacy of Peter and the apostolic succession of the popes is to ask, where in the Bible does Jesus commission Peter to a role as Bishop of Rome? While Peter certainly went to Rome, there's nothing to suggest that he was ever the head of the church there. He was martyred and buried, but that's a far cry from his ever being a bishop of the Roman Church Fellowship. Now, from a simple historical perspective, until the time of Damasus and Leo, while Rome's bishop was certainly regarded as a major leader, he wasn't considered the leader of the entire church. The evidence is clear both Damasus and Leo were astute enough to see that with Christianity's imperial acceptance, power would aggregate in fewer and fewer locations. Those locations were, as we've already remarked, Constantinople, Alexandria, Antioch, and of course Rome. Rome was the only city in the West. The other three were in the East. And with the political center now being in the East, Rome knew that it faced the very real threat of becoming irrelevant, as the church at Jerusalem already had. And so the bishops of Rome played their trump card. They were the one church to whom the names Peter and Paul had, well, some historical connection. While there had been several bishops of the church at Rome who had been capable leaders and under their guidance had established Rome as the premier church, if not in the whole Christian world, at least in the western portion of the now declining Roman Empire, it can be fairly said that for most of the earlier bishops, the person was eclipsed by the office. Bishops Callistus, Stephen, Damasus, and Innocent I all added significant authority to the Roman See. But it was Leo the Great who saw the Bishop of Rome become what we might call the first real pope. It was with Leo I that the idea of the papacy became real. While previous bishops at Rome had certainly been theologically astute, as befitted their office, Leo can be classed as a first-rate theologian, arguably the greatest theologian of any who came before in that office, and for at least a century and a half after. He battled the Manichaeist, Priscillianist, and Pelagian heresies, and won enduring fame for helping to finish codifying the Orthodox doctrine of the person of Christ. Leo's early life is shrouded in mystery. The chief source of information about him comes from his letters, and they don't commence until 442, when he was already an adult. Leo was most likely a Roman who became a deacon and then a legate under bishops Celestine I and Sixtus III. A legate is a special messenger sent by a bishop to carry messages to civil rulers. So think kind of a church ambassador to the king. You get the idea of what a legate was. Well, Leo was so astute in his task as a representative for the church that the Emperor Valentinian III sent him on a special mission to settle a dispute in Gaul between a couple of feuding generals. Now, this was at a time of great turmoil in the north due to the barbarian threat. While Leo was on this peacemaking mission, Bishop Sixtus died and Leo was chosen to take his seat. He served for the next 21 years. Now, Leo describes his feelings at the assumption of his office in a sermon. And he says, quote, "Lord, I've heard your voice calling me and I was afraid. I considered the work which was enjoined on me and I trembled. For what portion is there between the burden assigned to me and my weakness, this elevation and my nothingness? What is more to be feared than exaltation without merit, the exercise of the most holy functions being entrusted to one who is buried in sin? Oh, you have laid upon me this heavy burden. Bear it with me, I beseech you. Be my guide and my support. Unquote. Leo's papacy faced two immense problems. First was the emergence of heresies that threatened the integrity of the church. And second, the political disintegration of the Western Roman Empire. Leo offered three tactics in dealing with these difficulties. Number one, actions to provide essential church doctrine with a clear orthodox position. Number two, efforts to unify church government under a sovereign papacy. And three, attempts at peace by negotiating with the empire's enemies. Now, on the doctrinal front, Leo theologically refuted the era's main heresies and utilized imperial criminal prosecution and banishment to get rid of unrepentant heretics. His finest achievement was probably the formation and acceptance of an orthodox Christological dogma. Though Arianism was in retreat at this time, the 5th century battled with what's called Eutychianism. We're going to get into that in more depth in an upcoming episode. So for now, let me just say that Eutychianism was one of the 4th and 5th centuries attempts to understand the nature of Jesus. You know, is he God, is he man, or is he both? And if he's both, how do the two natures relate to each other? Eutychianism said that Jesus had two natures, human and divine, but that the divine had completely dominated the human nature, like a drop of vinegar is overwhelmed by the ocean. Later, it will come to be known as Monophysitism. Now, Leo's manner of dealing with this aberrant teaching was simply brilliant. Rather than just rely on suppression, he brought its main advocate, Eutychus, to Rome for lengthy discussions, and after painstaking research and deliberation, issued a carefully written letter, the famous Tome of Leo. It set forth a clear exposition of Christ's two natures in one person, and it became the basis in 451 for the Council of Chalcedon's enduring formulation of Christological doctrine. Now that alone would mark Leo as worthy of the honorific great, but he did more, a lot more. He rescued the city of Rome from destruction not once, but twice. When Attila and his Huns, known as the Scourge of God, destroyed the Italian city of Aquileia in 452, and everyone knew that Rome was next on the barbarians' hit list, Leo, with a couple of companions, traveled north, entered the Hun camp, and persuaded Attila to leave off sacking the city. Now think of it, a bishop's simple word accomplished what the waning strength of the once mighty Roman Empire could not, convince the barbarian hordes to go home. Then, 3 years later, when the Vandal king Gaiseric was poised to do what Attila had been deflected from, Leo was able to obtain a promise that the Vandals would relieve the city of its wealth, but neither burn it nor slay its people. Well, the sacking lasted for 2 weeks, but when the looters finally left, the city stood and its citizenry, though badly shaken, were still alive and eternally grateful for Leo's intervention. He died in 461 and was buried in the Church of St. Peter. Now, the literary works of Leo consist of nearly 100 sermons and over 170 letters. His collection of sermons is the first that we have from a Roman bishop. He declared preaching to be his sacred duty, and his sermons were short and simple. Leo was a man of extraordinary activity. He took a leading part in all the affairs of the church. While his private life is unknown, there's not a hint of anything that would give us cause to think that he was anything other than pure in both motive and morals. His zeal, time, and strength were all devoted to the interests of the faith. If Leo saw the faith primarily through the lens of the life and outreach of the church at Rome, we ought to attribute that to his conviction that Rome was meant by God to be the home base for the church, its headquarters, if you will. As church historian Philip Schaff said, Leo was animated by an unwavering conviction that God had committed to him, as the successor of Peter, the care of the whole church. He anticipated all of the arguments by which the power of the papacy was later established. Leo made the case that the rock on which the church is built, mentioned by Jesus in Matthew 16, meant Peter, and his confession of faith set the cornerstone for the faith. Leo claimed that while Christ himself is, in the highest sense, the rock and foundation of the church, his authority was transferred primarily to Peter. It was to Peter, specifically, that Christ entrusted the apostolic keys of the kingdom. Also, Jesus' prayer that Peter be strengthened so that he might strengthen others will seem to establish Peter's role as a leader among the apostles. Jesus' post-resurrection affirmation of Peter's call, "Feed my sheep," makes Peter the pastor and prince of the church entire, through whom Christ exercises his universal dominion on earth. But Leo went further. He said that Peter's primacy wasn't limited to the apostolic age. It endured in those subsequent bishops of Rome to whom Peter passed the authority Jesus endowed him with. Leo asserted only Rome could serve as the center of the church because it was both a political and religious center. Sure, Constantinople was political headquarters, but it lacked Rome's spiritual ancestry. Alexandria and Antioch were religious, but not political centers. No, only Rome provided sufficient political and spiritual weight to be the center of the earthly manifestation of the kingdom of God. While Leo made much of Rome's place as premier among the churches, he himself remained humble. This personal humility was offset by his determination that others would honor his office as though he were a modern Peter. Each year, a special celebration was called to commemorate his ascension to Peter's seat. He took such confusing titles as Servant of the Servants of God, Vicar of Christ, and even, God upon Earth. Now, I think it wise here to state that I am a non-denominational evangelical follower of Jesus. Listeners to the original audio podcast that this is an enlarged video version of left many comments. Some were convinced that I was a Roman Catholic. Others said that I had to be Eastern Orthodox, and still others that I was Reformed or Pentecostal, etc. They mistook what my personal views are in my attempt to treat the material in a relatively unbiased fashion. And I suspect that as I've just now shared Leo the Great's apologetic for the primacy of Peter, some wonder if I'm a Roman Catholic. So let me respond with this. While Leo made a good case for the bishop at Rome being the spiritual successor to Peter, what about the fact that Peter himself passes over his primacy in silence? In his New Testament letters, he expressly warned against hierarchical assumptions, while Leo used every opportunity to affirm his authority. In Antioch, when Peter played the hypocrite, he meekly submitted to the junior apostle Paul's rebuke. Leo, on the other hand, declared any resistance to his authority as an impious pride and a sure way to hell. Under Leo, obedience to the Pope was a condition to salvation. He claimed anyone not in harmony with Rome's see as the head of the body from which all gifts of grace descended was in fact not in the church at all, and so had no part in the grace of the body of Christ. Schaff wrote, quote, "This is the fearful but legitimate logic of the papal principle, which confines the kingdom of God to the narrow lines of a particular organization and makes the universal spiritual reign of Christ dependent on a temporal form and a human organ," unquote. Now, here's another important point. Crucial to the idea that the Bishop of Rome was and is the spiritual heir to Peter's apostolic authority is the assumption that Peter founded and led the church at Rome. There is simply not a shred of evidence for that. Yes, Peter went to Rome, but besides being buried there, there's no evidence that he ever functioned as a leader of the church. The assumption that he must have been because he was an apostle would be like assuming that Billy Graham had visited your city and attended your church for a few weeks, and so he must be the pastor, and later pastors could then claim that they operated in the authority and the ministry of Billy Graham. In carrying his ideas of the papacy into effect, Leo displayed a cunning diplomacy and consistency that characterized some of the popes of the Middle Ages. Certainly, the circumstances of the times were in his favor. This was the era of the fall of the Western Empire. The East was being torn apart by doctrinal controversies that we'll look at in later episodes. Africa was overrun by barbarians. The West was without political leadership, and there were no strong church leaders of the flavor of Athanasius or Jerome to lead. Leo took advantage of the Arian Vandals rampaging across North Africa, giving rise to the word that memorializes their career, Vandal, to write the bishops there in the tone of an overshepherd. They eagerly submitted to his authority in 443. He banished the last of the heretical Manichaeans and the Pelagians from Italy. And then in 444, Leo looked eastward and began affirming bishops to key posts, increasingly encroaching on territory that had been under the purview of Constantinople, Alexandria, and Antioch. But Leo reserved to himself a right of appeal by lower bishops in important cases. things which ought to be decided by the Pope according to divine revelation, said Leo.